Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Cases on Hold, number 62. We're going to start off by saying thank you for joining us all these times. Hope you're enjoying your summer months wherever you live. I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
We're glad that you're aboard here listening. Hopefully you're outside enjoying the wonderful weather if that's where you're at. If you're on the other side of the hemisphere, it's a little bit cold down there, so a little bit different. I just let you know that these opinions are our own, do not reflect anyone on the JBJS editorial board or the editorial staff at all. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. For those who participated in it, I hope you had a really good experience in both one and two, and hope you learned a lot from all of this. So without further ado, we're going to go top of the pile. What's new in musculoskeletal infection by Otero? It's permanently free. Transforming global orthopedic missions through adversity, lessons learned, and sustainable planning using quality assurance principles, the FAJR methodology by Hassan. From bedside manner to surgical excellence, a historical exploration and contemporary importance of empathy in orthopedic surgery by Suabib. What's important? Hashtag Ortho Twitter as an online community for orthopedic surgeons by Belair, and this is permanently free. We all know that social media use is trending, and it's definitely something of interest, so check that out about Ortho Twitter. We're going to start off the headline news. Dr. Schoenfeld is going to talk about 10-year survival rate of 82% in 262 cases of arthroscopic bone marrow stimulation for osteochondral lesions of the talus by Ricken. There is a visual summary, and it is permanently free.
This is an interesting study. I liked it because it's a reasonably sized sample, 262 included patients. The most attractive feature, of course, is the 10-year assessment in terms of follow-up. So that is, the real sellers here. Large study for this type of issue with really good holistic follow-up. So the authors, wanted to look at the cumulative survival rate analyzed using Kaplan-Meier, and then the secondary outcomes were the time to revision and the effects of several baseline factors: lesion size, primary or non-primary lesion type, preoperative cysts, and obesity, all well and good. They do this methodologically by, again, using Cox regression analyses, and they start making, they call it univariate, but it is bivariate comparisons. Multiple bivariate comparisons, if they find a certain p-value threshold, then they enter them into a multivariable model, and then they use backward selection to identify factors that remain predictive in terms of the outcome of revision. And again, for those who have been listening to even just a subset of our episodes over the last few years, you'll know that this is not a statistical approach that I'm especially fond of. I think that, what it does is it will preference those things that the study is powered to identify in lieu of others that may be informative or impactful, and they just don't have the numbers to make meaningful bivariate case-by-case comparisons. So you have the prospect for residual confounding. So when we're talking about the 10-year survival rate, I think the 10-year survival rate for this cohort, again, recognizing first that there may be some indication and expertise bias around this, but that in and of itself, I think, is very valuable and probably translational, as long as the practice that you're trying to translate it to is comparable in approach, et cetera, to the ones in which this data was collected from in the Netherlands. Once you get into like the secondary stuff around predictive factors and risk factors, I think there's some limitations and potential artifacts from the approach. I think there's another issue in that they consider lesion size, primary and non-primary lesion, preoperative cysts, and obesity, but there are a whole bunch of other factors that are playing into this: age, activity level, other medical comorbidities. I'd even say in this context that age, especially over the course of a decade, age, other illnesses, and reduced function may actually be competing factors for the need for a revision. if somebody was, and I think the average age of individuals here, you know, all cases, the average age is like 32, and then responders, non-responders, it's between 32 and 33. But if somebody was like really into basketball in their early 30s, by the time they get to their 40s, they're not really playing basketball as much. The ankle may have some problems, but it's not bothering them because they're not stressing it. You know what I'm saying? I think that the revision as the outcome may be actually a poor proxy for status of the ankle. There may be a lot of individuals who are having some issues with their ankles, but they don't really feel like undergoing another surgery, or where they are in their life, they don't really need another surgery, or they want to do the surgery and then they hear about the risk benefit breakdown from the surgeon and they're like, you know what, I'm just going to pass. So just because they didn't have a revision doesn't mean that they had a great outcome. You know, maybe they had a less than ideal outcome, but where what they've done in their life is they're now at a point where it's not as problematic for them, or they don't need the ankle performance to be at the level that they did when they had the surgery. So I think there are some limitations associated with this. I think for individuals who perform these surgeries, there is useful information that can be used to inform patient care, and it's probably best available evidence, I think, in terms of that, you know, really robustly assessing 10-year survival. So very useful and worth checking out for our foot and ankle colleagues. They do appropriately designate it level 4 evidence. I think they are realistic about some of the limitations associated with it, but there are also some of these other things. I think that the, you know, as I was reading this, thinking about the competing factors that may play into an individual's either lack of need for revision, even if the, you know, you could have very restricted range of motion in the ankle, but they're just doing a sedentary desk job. They're not out running. They're not trying to ride a bike. They're not really appreciating that the ankle isn't as good as it could be.
All right, we're going to switch a little bit here and talk about preoperative laboratory values predicting periprosthetic joint infection in morbidly obese patients undergoing total hip or knee arthroplasty by Tiang et al. We all know that obesity is increasing worldwide, and there are mixed study results with regards to outcomes after total hip and total knee arthroplasty patients, especially morbidly obese patients. And one of the most commonly studied outcomes is periprosthetic joint infection. Typically, it talks about reinfection rates, how prognosis, things like that. The purpose of this study was to identify preoperative laboratory values that may serve as predictors of periprosthetic joint infection in morbidly obese patients undergoing total hip arthroplasty or total knee arthroplasty. The study was conducted using the Premier Healthcare Database on 6,780 primary elective total hip or total knee arthroplasty patients who had BMIs greater than 40 kilograms per meter squared from 2016 to 2021. But it only contains 25% of all inpatient admissions throughout the United States. That's by definition what the Premier Healthcare Database contains. Patients had to have one set of preoperative laboratory tests within 28 days before total joint arthroplasty, and patients who developed PJI within 90 days after surgery were to compare with patients who did not develop PJI. How was PJI defined? It wasn't truly stated. It was probably all through ICD-10 or 9 coding, or actually, sorry, ICD-10 coding, because it started from 2016. Univariate and multivariate regression analysis were utilized to assess the association between periprosthetic joint infection and preoperative lab values, including total lymphocyte count, neutrophil lymphocyte count, also known as NLR, the platelet lymphocyte count, which is PLR, monocyte lymphocyte ratio, which is MLR, systemic immune inflammation index, SII, albumin level, platelet count, albumin globulin ratio, hemoglobin level, and hemoglobin A1C. Again, there's only 90 days of follow-up, and that's just because of due to the database, so that is a limitation. The results were as follows. Well, first, there were mostly total knee patients. More than 75% of them were total knees, and the remainder were total hips. Of all these patients, there was a 0.7% PJI reduction, PJI rate within 90 days of surgery, so not a huge amount. So remember, we're comparing those who got PJI who were morbidly obese to versus those who didn't. So that number is really small. It's only 47 out of over the 6,500 patients in this study. 0.6% of them occurred in total knee arthroplasty, and 0.95% occurred after total hip arthroplasty. There were no significant differences in age, sex, race, marital status, hospital bedside, urban or rural setting, teaching status, or geographic region between the patients who did or did not develop periprosthetic joint infection. The study found that preoperative anemia, defined differently for men and women by the WHO classification, abnormal platelet count, an elevated LNLR, PLR, and systemic immune inflammatory index were associated with an increased risk of periprosthetic joint infection among patients with a body mass index greater than 40 kilograms per meter squared. Interestingly enough, hemoglobin A1C and hypoalbuminemia were not associated with PJ risk, although there's a lot of other studies that have demonstrated that that is associated with increased PJ risk, but not specifically in the obese patient population. The thing what I like about this study is that it does look at risk factors that were present before surgery. The real question I asked, though, is would correcting these factors actually decrease the risk of infection? Studies have shown that if you decrease hemoglobin A1C to be under 7% or under 8%, that does improve the risk of, or decrease the risk of infection. Hypoalbuminemia, if you decrease hypoalbuminemia or make albumin normal, that can decrease the risk of infection. They found all these other variables such as anemia, which has been associated with infection, but all those other blood count variables as well too. If we affect those, will that really change the outcome? You also can include other factors that increase the risk of periprosthetic joint infection, such as smoking and socioeconomic status, besides just high body mass index. And another different laboratory thresholds for non-obese patients. For example, they use different thresholds for all these different blood counts that are standardly found. Is it different for obese patients? But the authors did allude to the fact that they are doing current work in this area and hope to have more work in this area.
I think you hit on many of the issues that that I had, you know, concerns about. I think the another major challenge here is that this is done, as you mentioned, with Premier Healthcare claims data. You don't really know what the clinical circumstances were under which these laboratory values were being obtained. And sometimes the linkages, especially if you have longitudinal data, it's not really clear what is supposed to be linked with what. Like if you have a patient record over the course of like several years, and then you see they have this hospitalization event associated with the ICD code for the infection, right? And then like how far back are you looking at the labs, right? If you're looking at the labs just in the context of the hospitalization event, well, that's going to be different. They may already know that they had an infection. They're not using those labs to suss out the infection. It may have been the labs from 3 months previous that they were starting to try and look at this. And sometimes it's diagnosed a different way. So I think it's very hard to use laboratory values from claims data when you don't have the real clinical granularity around understanding the purpose, the intent. Laboratory values all have a Bayesian component to them. The very fact of ordering them, you're increasing the likelihood that you're going to have an abnormal finding. Like just the fact that you ordered them, there was something that triggered that ordering event, which means that relative to someone who didn't have it ordered, these patients are more likely to have a problem in the lab tests that were ordered. You see what I'm saying?
I do. That makes sense. Inherent problem with the ordering in the labs. Sorry, I heard for the labs.
Right. Inherent problem wrapped in an enigma, which is also part of a conundrum. Yeah, I think these authors do fall into the trap. It's common. It's not just unique to them, but of trying to use claims-based data to inform direct clinical practice. And you really can't do that.
They're all part of it. It's all this retrospective data. And it's a little bit of data mining, right? What do we have? You know, I have a hammer and a nail. I have to hit the nail with the hammer.
At best, it's hypothesis generating, at best.
There you go. Good way to put it. I like that. All right. The Your Cases on Hold featurette. Low-dose aspirin is the safest prophylaxis for prevention of venous thromboembolism after total knee arthroplasty across all patient risk profiles. A lot of definitive statements here.
Haven't you already shown this in your own research, though?
This has been multiple times.
Haven't we already discussed this paper done by someone else earlier?
But it's a different scale and a different view of things. And it starts about talking about the international consensus meeting on VTE, which was done in 2022. So it's now 2024. So of course, we have to update it. Hence why we're here today. This is by Lauv, and there's a commentary and an infographic. Is aspirin the best? Just as Dr. Schoenfeld alluded to, there's been a lot of debate about this in the past. It has definitely been less of a debate in the more recent time frame, because a lot of people have switched to aspirin as post-op DVD prophylaxis for ease of use and access. Again, this international consensus meeting suggests low-dose aspirin. This does say previous meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials have found lower rates of VTE with rivaroxaban. So the purpose of the study was to evaluate the trends in aspirin utilization for risk-stratified patients undergoing total knee arthroplasty, as well as to determine the rates of VTE and 90-day postoperative outcomes among patients receiving low-dose aspirin compared with alternative VTE prophylaxis. They used Trinex. They used the U.S. Collaborative Network within that, which is a collection of 60 healthcare institutions in the country. We've talked about databases. There's pluses and minuses to it. This included patients who were undergoing primary total knee arthroplasty between 2012 and 2022 using a CPT code, which is the primary total knee code 27447. They looked at all different medications. So they looked at low-dose aspirin, which is defined as 81 milligrams, high-dose aspirin, which is 325 milligrams, warfarin, unfractionated heparin, factor 10A inhibitors, and direct thrombin inhibitors. And they had to be used for 14 days post-op. But it'd been nice to see in the study to see if they have different comparatives of duration of time of these medications that were given, and if there were differences as well there too. But they just said had to be used for 14 days post-op, and that's it. I personally use it for 30 days post-op or 29, 8 days post-op, different regimens there, but 4 weeks post-op, essentially. They did separate patients into high and low-risk patients based on previous studies of comorbidities. Is high risk of VTE versus low risk of VTE, and to see if the different type of anticoagulations made a difference there. Patients were excluded if they received high-dose aspirin chemoprophylaxis from, they had a retrospective outcomes analysis, as the ICM, that International Consensus Meeting meta-analysis, demonstrated a higher VTE risk compared with low-dose aspirin. There was matching too. So they did do propensity score matching. They said the odds of deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolus, bleeding events, infections, mortality, and hospitalizations were assessed in the 90-day postoperative period for propensity-matched cohorts receiving low-dose aspirin only versus other prophylaxis, segregating patients by the VTE risk profile. So they tried to, you know, take the patients, and they dug them deeper into low versus the high dose. They compared DVT, PE, hemorrhage, hematoma, GI bleeding, PJI, surgical site infection, myocardial infarction, stroke, mortality, revision, ED visits, readmission on the 90 days postoperative between regimens within each risk profile. And they also did have comparisons of low-dose aspirin with rivaroxaban only and low-dose regimen versus other regimens as well. So not surprisingly, the proportion of patients who received low-dose aspirin as part of their DVT prophylaxis increased from approximately 8% to 55% from 2012 to 2022. Interestingly enough, the rates of DVT and PE among patients decreased from 2.3% to 1.7%. Decreased from 2.3% to 1.1% for DVT, and PE reduced from 1.7% to 1.1%. During the same time frame. So even though low-dose aspirin went up, the rates of DVT and PE went down. And the proportion of patients who received high-dose aspirin did decrease as more patients were taking low-dose aspirin. Low-risk patients were not surprisingly more likely to receive low-dose aspirin and high-dose aspirin versus all the other medications like rivaroxaban and the factor 10 inhibitors, et cetera. For propensity score matching, it took 15,000 patients. And they had high-risk patients in both the low-dose aspirin-only and other anticoagulant-resistant groups. In this high-dose, high-risk patients, 12% of the patients were on chronic aspirin use, and 3% of the patients had chronic anticoagulant use. I would think that number of patients on chronic anticoagulant use would have been actually higher. The odds of DVT and PE were reduced for those high-risk patients receiving low-dose aspirin-only prophylaxis. They also had a decreased odds of bleeding events, including hemorrhage, hematoma, and GI bleeding. When they looked at patients were high risk receiving low-dose aspirin versus high-risk patients receiving rivaroxaban, the patients were getting the low-dose aspirin, even though they were high-risk, had lower odds of DVT and PE, but no difference in bleeding rates. Very similar findings in the low-risk patients. So 5% of the low-risk patients had chronic aspirin use and 1% of the patients had chronic anticoagulant use. The odds of DVT and PE were markedly lower in the 90-day postoperative period for the low-dose aspirin-only prophylaxis cohort in the low-risk patients. The odds of hemorrhage and GI bleeding were lower among patients receiving low-dose aspirin versus other regimens. There was no difference in thromboembolic outcomes between low-risk patients receiving low-dose aspirin only and rivaroxaban only. And the odds of DVT were lower among low-risk patients receiving low-dose aspirin chemoprophylaxis versus low-risk patients receiving it into other anticoagulants. There's a lot of low, a lot of high, and a lot of other in what I'm trying to break down here. The high-risk cohort getting low-dose aspirin only had lower surgical site infection, mortality, myocardial infarction, stroke, on all-cause revisions, ED visits, and readmission. Very similar things for the low-risk cohort, but no difference in periprosthetic joint infection. Low-dose aspirin was found to be superior to other chemoprophylactic agents for the prevention of VTE in all patients, including low-risk and high-risk VTE patients. That is their overarching conclusion in the study. My biggest problem with these type of database studies is we still don't know why the anticoagulation option was chosen. We don't know why aspirin was given. We don't know why low-dose aspirin was given or high-dose aspirin was given or rivaroxaban or any of the medications. We don't know why they were given. They were just given. And so because of that, we can't make definitive conclusions as you would in a different setting where you purposely assign people certain drugs. But it's an interesting database study because it's a lot of patients. And it does look at the low-dose aspirin again, and it does look at a separation of the low versus high-risk patients.
Yes, I think, you know, within the context of the limitations associated with the data set and the claims-based data, some of which we just finished talking about on the previous article, these authors really did as high quality a job as you could hope for. The propensity score matching approach and how they went about it all, you know, makes very good intuitive sense. You don't have that clinical granularity as you just mentioned. I think they fall into the same trap that we just talked about using or basing evidentiary prescriptive treatment recommendations on retrospective claims-based data. And you really can't do that piece. But I think this does continue to add to the growing body of literature supporting low-dose aspirin. They do have Dr. Parvizi as an author on this. He was really at the forefront of that movement, as you're aware. And, you know, I think overall, it's a large data set, recent data, good statistical approach with best practices followed as far as the propensity score matching. You know, so within the context, it's the highest quality level three evidence that you could really hope for. Is this, and I'm asking this not facetiously, is this something where there's going to be another randomized trial doing this? It just seems like you would never get an IRB to agree to randomization of high-risk patients, I don't think.
Yeah, it's really interesting. In all honesty, data like this would support using it in high-risk patients, in all honesty, right? So, you know, it's not worth
it. Yeah, it would help you make the case. I just don't know that an IRB would be comfortable.
It's a great question. And then the hard part is like obesity is high risk, right? So in those type of patients, it's probably fine in all honesty, right? But if a patient who has had like a myocardial infarction, that's also high risk. So I think you'd have to be very specific about what you say is high risk. Like there's a study that we did randomizing different types of like antibiotic powder versus povidone iodine in total joint patients and defined high risk as patients with diabetes. Well, there's well-controlled diabetes and that's considered high risk, but it's not that high risk, I'd say, right? So you're right. You don't have a patient who's had a previous DVT or PE to be randomized to, you know, aspirin, for example, right? So you're right, an IRB would probably not accept very high-risk patients, but depends how you define high risk, I'd say. But do we need another prospective randomized controlled trial on this? That's the bigger question, I'd say, is there's a PEPPER study going on right now. Dr. Pellegrini is doing a great job leading that. And now it's down to two arms of aspirin versus rivaroxaban. And we'll see what the results show. They need 20,000 patients. That's a lot of patients. To replicate that and do that again, take years and years and years and a lot of money. And so I think some study like that might put the nail in the coffin for a long period of time until something else comes out that you might want some comparison to. But for now, probably don't need it.
In today's environment, though, you know, it used to be that you'd have some kind of study, and there are even some studies that people are still using to inform their practice that I feel that they shouldn't be. Like we still find people who are citing the Patchell study on treatment of spinal metastases, and that study, like the last patients were enrolled 22 years ago. Study was published in 2006. It's like, okay, but you know, that's probably more historical at this point in time. But now it's just like studies that you think are going to be these landmark you know, for decades, this is going to stand as the sine qua non of what we're supposed to be doing. It's like 3 years later, there's something else that it's just the pace at which research is being produced. It's you can't realistically keep up with it. That's why you have us.
That's why you have us. We will summarize it for you and give you some good information or do the research, whichever one you want.
Yeah, we do it both. We do both things.
On it. All right. Going on to our honorable mentions. Peroneal nerve decompression in patients with multiple hereditary exostosis, indications, complications, and recurrence. This is by Hooser et al. It is permanently free. Indications for peroneal nerve decompression included neurological symptoms and pain. The odds of a complication increase with excision of anterior osteochondromas and previous decompression. Reoccurrence of symptoms following decompression osteochondroma excision was found exclusively in skeletally immature patients. Next, we have an effective program to reduce malpractice claims and payments in a large orthopedic practice by Cooper et al. It's also permanently free. They developed this, the Patient Advocacy Reporting System program. It was successfully adopted within a surgical specialty group as a part of ongoing risk prevention and management efforts. They looked at the period after they implemented this patient advocacy reporting system, and it was associated with reduction in malpractice claim costs. Now, this was done retrospectively, of course, after it was implemented. They showed that in their practice, this could be effectively implemented in a large single specialty orthopedic practice setting. And although not necessarily causal, they had reduced malpractice claim costs. So something that you might want to implement to practice if you're interested. Diaphyseal impaction grafting combined with metaphyseal cones, outcome in 88 revision total knee arthroplasties by Bedard et al. When presented with a sclerotic polished diaphyseal canal with deficient cancellous bone and concomitant metaphyseal bone loss, the technique of combining diaphyseal impaction grafting with a metaphyseal cone proved durable in a series of 88 revision total knee arthroplasties, which is seen as large in this subset of patients that undergo this. No cone impaction graft reconstructs required re-revision for aseptic loosening. Cognitive behavioral-based physical therapy for improving recovery after a traumatic lower extremity injury, the result of a randomized controlled trial by Archer et al. There's an infographic. So we talk a lot about positive outcomes in orthopedic surgery. Well, this is one that showed something a little bit different. The telephone-delivered cognitive behavioral therapy did not appear to yield any benefit for patients with traumatic lower extremity injuries in terms of physical function, pain intensity, pain interference, or general health. Improvements were observed in both groups, even if they didn't get the cognitive behavioral therapy, and which questions the utility of these telephone-delivered strategies over educational programs. And finally, the LUMIC endoprosthetic reconstruction of periacetabular tumor defects, a multi-center follow-up study by Evenhus et al., which is permanently free. Despite the substantial reoperation risk using this LUMIC endoprosthetic device, it demonstrated durability in the midterm and said median follow-up of 4.2 years with a low mechanical revision rate and most patients retaining their primary implant. Most complications occurred in the first postoperative months, and patients with previous surgery at the same site had an increased dislocation risk and might benefit from more conservative rehabilitation and aftercare. Thanks so much for joining us again. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode of Your Case is on Hold.
See you then.